I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Democrats pounced on Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett's comments on a radio show last week about jobs in the Commonwealth. Here's what he said.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me because we're having a serious problem with that.
Corbett complained his critics misrepresented what he said for their own political game. He said he was referring to complaints from heads of gas drilling firms who told him they were having a hard time finding applicants who could pass a drug test for a training program. Nonetheless, his comments have taken on a life of their own and put a spotlight on the slow job growth in Pennsylvania, which lags behind many other states. We're going to begin our conversation with David N. Taylor. He's executive director and first vice president of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. That's a statewide trade organization representing the interests of manufacturers in the state's public policy processes since, looks like, 1909. And Dave Taylor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. So how big a problem are our possible employees or prospective employees who can't pass a drug test?
Well, there are major challenges for employers today to find qualified employees. I had the honor of serving on the governor's manufacturing advisory council, and of all the issues facing the manufacturing sector, this was the one that by consensus emerged as the number one concern. And now, of course, it's multifaceted. That, you know, at sort of the upper end, there's a lack of the advanced skills that manufacturers need, the sort of the science, technology, engineering, and math dimension. But also, more broadly, there is a lack of available employees who can have that the soft skills, getting at reading comprehension, being able to follow instructions, being able to do basic math, having the internal discipline to show up to work on time, but also the ability to pass the drug test. It's a very real concern, and that this element needs to be addressed. I, for one, am just sort of baffled at why the governor's remarks would spur such outrage when what he's saying is 100% true.
Well, let me pick up on that. And are we talking anecdotally? Has the Manufacturers Association, have you done research on the percentage of people applying for jobs in the manufacturing industry that cannot pass a drug test?
Well, it is difficult to quantify because what I hear, and I do hear this issue every time that I meet at a regional manufacturing association or a CEO roundtable, that this issue of finding qualified new hires arises because the people who I talk with describe having to go through hundreds of applicants to find even a handful of qualified new hires, and that one of the big impediments is being able to pass the drug test, and that people, when they're told that there's a drug test, they just walk away. So when you already have companies spending all kinds of time, energy, effort, and resources just to get those couple of new hires, there's no time or manpower to chase people down the hallway as they leave to ask them why they abandoned their job application. But I'd like to describe why in the manufacturing sector this is so important to us. You know, if you think about it, on a factory floor, you have heavy machinery, you have bladed instruments, you have chemical reactions, you have extreme temperatures. There are a lot of very consequential things that happen on that plant floor. And I would hope that we would all agree, Democrats, Republicans, business, and labor, that the only acceptable number of workplace injuries is zero. That we all agree that employers should be responsible, that they should abide by the law, that they should have all of the licenses, permits, and insurances in place for a safe workplace, including their workers' comp insurance. We would also all agree that employers should be honest with the insurance carrier that they're operating a safe workplace. So again, we should all commit that the number of workplace injuries should be zero, and we should, I hope we would all also agree that for people who are out of work and looking to return to the dignity of work, that we would want them to be able to get a job. And so people should understand that that this is one of the most preventable and correctable impediments to employment. And it's not about the boss being a prude or saying that you shouldn't have fun on the weekends. It's saying, I can't get the insurance coverage to lawfully operate my workplace if my employees are not clean.
Well, I have a couple of questions, follow-up questions there, and I would agree with you. I think everyone wants a safe workplace. They want to make sure that employees working in that workplace are not using drugs or using alcohol, for that matter. And I'm curious about, is there an alcohol test as well?
Well, I mean, certainly. Anybody who shows up not sober in a workplace gets flagged immediately and sent home, if not fired. Yeah, I mean, chemical dependency broadly is a problem, but you know, again, it is possible to, you know, to use alcohol in a responsible way, whereas with controlled substances that there isn't. And even if, you know, again, what employer or what insurer is going to accept the excuse from an employee? Yeah, well, I use some, but I make sure that I only use on the weekends, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't interfere with my work hours. No responsible employer is going to accept that excuse.
And I'm curious about what drugs are being tested for. When you talk about a controlled substance, is it marijuana? Is it heroin?
Well, I mean, it's a broad spectrum. I mean, I believe that most employers use a broad spectrum test, and so I'm not sure. And again, it's less the pass less the problem that people can't pass the test is that people walk away when they're told that the test comes. But I mean, I know that there's a marijuana problem. I know that there's a methamphetamine problem. You know, depends on the community, depends on the applicant.
And does it also depend on the regions in the state? Have you found that some regions are more impacted by this than others?
Well, I mean, again, it's difficult to quantify. I mean, I've heard these complaints from employers all across the Commonwealth, you know, in the Northeast, in the Mid-State, in the West. You know, a friend of mine who is an executive in the mining industry, you know, said that there's a methamphetamine problem in the West. But again, we want a safe workplace. We want the skilled workforce that can, you know, get the job done. And also, I mean, Marty, in my sector, these manufacturing jobs pay 25% or more than the average non-manufacturing job. And, you know, these are good jobs with benefits. And, you know, we want people to be able to do these jobs so we can hire them, so we can get the work done. There are thousands of these jobs that go lacking. You know, for that broad spectrum of reasons that I stated at the outset, but including the drug use question. And so, I mean, the estimates that I've heard in Pennsylvania would be, you know, 7,000, 6,000, you know, manufacturing jobs that my guys would hire for today if only they could find qualified people. I met with the president of the National Association of Manufacturers last week, and he put the nationwide number at about 600,000.
Well, I'm quoting here Mark Zandi. He's a chief economist with Moody Analytics. He gets quoted a lot, and he was quoted on this particular issue. His analysis is that there isn't good data to support the claim that there's so many people using drugs that they can't be employed, and that employers are more, and I'm quoting here, more picky. You agree?
Well, I mean, that's one of the challenges for, you know, for potential employees in the current situation, that when unemployment is higher, that employers can be more selective. But you know, again, when it comes to this particular issue, this is not a selectivity issue. This is a baseline workplace safety issue.
Well, and I'm also wondering, and we've been focusing on the drug comment by Tom Corbett, and you're saying that the governor was correct in those comments, but I'm wondering about things like education, the ability to show up on time, all the kinds of day-to-day skills that I would assume you and other manufacturers are looking for. Do you find that employees have those as well?
No, I mean, those are contributing factors, and it's in that same universe of soft skills that are too often lacking among the applicants that come through the door when manufacturers have openings. And so, I mean, this is why our association has long been supportive of education reform, you know, charter schools, virtual schools, that all of our young people deserve an educational experience that is challenging, meaningful, rigorous, and prepares them for success in life, including success in the workplace.
What about the idea of workforce training or education, the Manufacturers Association doing some of that work so that, let's say, someone who lost their job, they started doing drugs, they have some skills deficit, that your organization could help this person then get a job?
Well, this is, Marty, in Pennsylvania, there's about $1.6 billion of state and federal taxpayer money that goes into job training and workforce development programs. Now, unfortunately, those resources are spread across dozens of programs under multiple state cabinet departments, and insofar as they involve federal monies, that there are strings attached there where they can only be used for certain purposes. One of the things that we support is asking the U.S. Secretary of Labor for a waiver to allow Pennsylvania to break down the walls between those different funding streams so that we can adapt them to better match the needs that currently exist in Pennsylvania.
I'm wondering about, and we only have a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye here, but even looking at vo-tech schools, you had mentioned charter schools, and I'm assuming you include public schools as well.
Are all public schools. All of those charter schools are, in fact, public schools. But yes, we need to completely reinvent the vocational technical career training system. And, you know, one of the big challenges that we face is that, you know, there's kind of an ingrained bias of, you know, principals and guidance counselors and superintendents and certainly, you know, parents too, that everyone, you know, chases the golden ticket of a four-year undergraduate degree when, you know, in fact, for a lot of young people, that a career in a skilled trade or in manufacturing would be, you know, more rewarding financially, but also, you know, a better fit for their skills. And that, you know, when we stigmatize any choice that a young person would make other than pursuing a four-year degree, it results in a huge misallocation of human capital. I mean, there are great family-sustaining careers that are available in manufacturing, and that, again, that needs to be part of a public awareness effort to make people understand the career choices that are available.
Do you think unions have a role to play in helping address this issue?
Absolutely. Yeah, the private sector unions and their apprentice programs, those are very valuable in helping to train the workforce of the future. I mean, this is the challenge we're up against. The manufacturing workforce is in its late 50s in general. We're talking about baby boomer generation folks who are getting close to retirement, and there is no youth cadre behind them to succeed them to fill those roles. So this is a very big challenge for the manufacturing sector. And remember that the manufacturing sector is the engine that drives the economy. It adds the most value and has the strongest spin-off effect on jobs in supply chains and distribution networks. So if you lose that core manufacturing function, all those ancillary jobs go away too.
And we're just about out of time here. How many then openings in manufacturing in Pennsylvania today?
Well, the total manufacturing workforce is about 575,000 Pennsylvanians, and of course that manufacturing activity sustains millions of additional jobs. But again, the jobs that people would like to hire for, where we can't find people, the best number I've heard is about 7,000.
About 7,000 out of that. David N. Taylor, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My great pleasure.
And he's executive director, the first vice president of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. We'll be carrying on our conversation with our second guest, Paul Harrington, talking about Pennsylvania and how to improve the skill set for potential employees. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
Let me take these few seconds to thank the many listeners who expressed support of our program services during HYY's recent campaign. You continue to come through at a time of further declines in traditional sources of revenue. The result, well, it matters tremendously. I'm Bill Morazzo, WHYY's president, and thanks to you, we're growing our investments in program services, and they're designed to help you stay engaged in your community. You count on us, and we count on you. Thank you.
Next time in Studio 360...
The short and talented Mel Brooks.
So you, I'm working for Mel Brooks.
What's funny, this is human behavior. Now, if we just exaggerate a little bit, these are what fools we are.
Mel Brooks is my guest next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You can't beat that.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, chuckling with Paul Harrington, our second guest. As we know, Pennsylvania lags behind many other states when it comes to job creation. The unemployment rate is higher than the national average, and thousands of people have been laid off in the last few years as state and local governments have made some budget cuts. Governor Corbett revealed last week that business leaders have told him that it's tough to find potential employees who can pass a drug test. I just said goodbye to David and Taylor. And now I welcome Paul Harrington to Radio Times, labor economist and director of Drexel University Center for Labor Markets and Policy. And Paul, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us on.
I'd like to ask you the same question, and just I'd be curious about your response to what David Taylor was talking about. The governor saying that there's a problem of people either failing this drug test or not even taking it, kind of turning around and walking out the door because they find out they have to take a drug test in order to apply for a job. Is this a serious problem?
I'm sure it's serious for any given manufacturer. You know, if you're trying to understand why we have high unemployment rates, why we're not generating jobs, probably doesn't have much to do with that. But that there may be certain labor market segments where we're trying to hire at a particular wage level where there might be some drug problems. But a lot of it's pretty anecdotal. We just don't know much about it. The broader complaint around behavioral traits, you find that in a lot of labor market segments around dependability, self-control, reliability. Those are important issues as well.
And why are those an issue? And we're talking, I guess, about people showing up on time,
right,
coming to work, the sort of basics of employment. Why is that an issue?
Well, probably a couple of things. One, let me just step back and put this in a little bit of a context. If you ask yourself, okay, we've got about 550,000 people unemployed in the state. What fraction of them have these sort of barriers, or potential fraction of them have these barriers around behavior or skill gap or the like? And the answer is probably three-quarters of the unemployment problem in the state has just got to do with job deficits. We just don't have the level of demand in the state economy to put people to work. And that's really the fundamental economic problem. And that's not a Pennsylvania problem. That's an American problem. And that's why you see the Federal Reserve buying $85 billion worth of bonds every month and the president trying to get stimulus going.
To get the demand up.
Exactly.
Right?
So this has been an economy that's crashed between 2008 and 2010 and has very, very slowly recovered. And so this anemic job growth is the primary reason why we have these high and difficult unemployment rates. Within that, I think probably about three-quarters of the problem are just pure job deficit problem. And we could put everybody to work tomorrow, and our unemployment rate would go from, 7.9 down to, maybe 6.5. Underneath this is then some of these behavioral problems. We primarily pick this up among teens. It's really in the teen labor market job where,
It's
the kids entering the job market. And, one of the things we've seen there, Marty, is a lot of substitution of older workers for teens because there are a lot of older worker labor supply willing to enter these teen labor market jobs. So firms have kind of – there's an easy workaround because it's an excess labor supply problem. So the idea that these behavioral traits and these drug traits are stopping firms from filling jobs seems very unlikely to me.
Well, let me pick up on something, and this notion of excess labor, which is – I guess you're saying we really don't have enough jobs for everybody.
Right.
Does that then mean that employers can be picky? I mean, because in a sense – They can look at 550,000 people in Pennsylvania who are out of work and be very picky about who they select.
Well, it's actually much more than that because you've got 550,000 people who are out of work. Then you have, if you add on to this, people who have withdrawn from the job market but have a job desire and people who are involuntarily part-time. What you find is that the underutilization problem in the state is not 8%. It's about 14%.
Oh.
So there's a lot of people, and then add on to that, at any point in time, 5 to 6% of employed people are looking for jobs. So there's massive amounts of labor supply out there, and in fact, there's so much that firms have gone onto these online applicant systems because the human resource systems can't handle it.
They just can't handle all the people looking for
a
job.
Right. So, and they do automated screening, personality profiling. So there's a lot of testing done before the person even talks to a human being. And you find that this isn't in high-end jobs. This is, you'll find, you know, big box retail stores is very common, fast food organizations. They're all pretty much engaged in this activity now.
Yeah, a lot of hurdles to
there's a lot of hurdles to jump through, exactly right. Second thing is that when you take so for example, we heard earlier that there were 600,000 vacant jobs in manufacturing, but the Bureau of Labor Statistics just released its job vacancy survey this morning, and the number of manufacturing job vacancies this last in March was actually 260,000. So it's less than half what the Manufacturing Association is, and that job vacancy rate, which you can think of as an unemployment rate, it's sort of the demand side equivalent. Job vacancy rate in manufacturing is 2.1%.
Oh, that's small.
Yeah, so you probably have somewhere around six unemployed, experienced unemployed manufacturing workers for every vacant job in that industry.
But do you think Pennsylvania is an outlier? I mean, some have said it's 49th when it comes to job creation. I've seen others saying it's more like in the 30s in terms of job creation.
Yeah, I actually
go ahead.
I went back and took a look at the data before I came over, and the answer is it's Pennsylvania's in the low 40s. That when you take a look at a state, what you see is that we lost about 246,000 jobs from the beginning of the recession to the job trough, and we've gotten back about 175,000. So we're still about 70,000 jobs short of where we were 5 years ago, and that's not terribly different. That's about sort of the run of the mill for the country as a whole, which says we're Pennsylvania is part of in this broader, more difficult economic context. When you look at the manufacturing sector, though, and this is really, I think, a bigger problem, between 1980 and 2000, manufacturing in the country accounted for about 17 million jobs, somewhere between 17 million, depending where you were in the business cycle. After 2000, the manufacturing sector collapsed, and it went down to, by the trough of the recession, down to about 11,000, and it's just about 11 million, and it's just not coming back.
Those jobs have disappeared. They've gone overseas.
Well, a lot of this has got to do with technological change. The technologies, the productivity gains that we've generated in manufacturing are astonishing. One of the reasons why firms became so profitable over the course of the economic recession was these huge, huge productivity gains. We were getting massive gains back in 08, 09, 10 because we were substituting a lot of capital for labor. The Obama administration put these great investment tax credits for firms to substitute capital for labor, and they did it. And they got huge productivity gains, and that was an important component of generating the GDP growth. It also meant profits rose, not labor. Okay, and so most of the gain went to profits most of the GDP gain went to profits rather than workers. Good news, I guess, in some sense, but not much of a job creator. And in the manufacturing sector, that's really, I think, the future. That manufacturing sales, I think, are going to be pretty good in the U.S., but it's not at all clear that we're going to add a lot of manufacturing jobs.
And I want to pick up on that, but there's something else, and I don't know, I don't think this is unique to Pennsylvania. It certainly happened in Wisconsin because of public budget cuts. Thousands of teachers have been laid off in the state. Other government workers have been laid off in the state. How does that add, I guess, to some of the problems, the challenges in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, when you take a look at government job loss, it actually during the course of the recession, we didn't have any government layoffs. That came after the jobs downturn. Then municipal budgets tightened up. The stim went away. So all of a sudden, we had to get that tightening. We lost about 40,000, government jobs in the state. So that that's going to depress employment a little bit. But primarily our problems in the state are really private sector, trying to figure out how we get that private sector to grow. Because if you don't have a strong private sector, the government sector is just not going to be able to do much.
But are we facing a situation, maybe because of technology, because of globalization, where we just may not create enough jobs in this country for everyone that wants to work?
I don't think that's the case. I think if we have proper monetary and fiscal policies, we can figure some of this out and have some patience. I think it's possible to get the economy back to full employment where the ratio between the number of people seeking a job and the number of job vacancies is about 1-to-1. And I think that would get us to an unemployment rate of about 3.5%, 4%.
In our lifetime?
Well, that's another issue, right? But I think that's I think that's a possibility. The question is there's so much instability around the world that every time we start getting a little bit of growth – something blows up in Europe or, we get in a dispute in Congress or China gets a little shaky and, consumers get more cautious and we back off. And, last two or three years, we've kind of I describe it as sort of, bouncing along the bottom. And that's what it seems to me. And that that doesn't look to me like we're going to get out of that very quickly.
Let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Paul Harrington, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. He's a labor economist, also director of Drexel University's Center for Labor Markets and Policy. We asked him to join us today in Radio Times to look at Pennsylvania and job growth and training and skills, and to take calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So is there a skills disconnect in that you've got people, employers who want to hire people, but they're looking for people with very specific skills, and either we don't have schools or community colleges or vo-tech schools that are graduating people with the skills that employers are looking for?
I think if to the extent that there are any kind of sort of skill shortages, and I don't think there's much evidence of them at all.
Oh, interesting.
I find it very unconvincing. But to the extent we do, they're really in high-end labor markets, information technology, some of the engineering fields, oftentimes for persons with experience. I met with a group of employers in the IT field a few weeks ago, and they weren't having so much trouble at the entry level, four-year college entry level. It was people with 3 to 5 years experience in the IT arena. Well, why 3 to 5 years experience? Well, because back in the recession, they didn't hire anybody. And so that sort of internal training pipeline breaks, and they don't have anybody with – because a lot of that IT business is still very experiential. And so they've had more difficulty in that. But kids coming out of those programs are doing well. There's a lot of opportunity, very high wages and the like. You know, and this kind of what people sometimes call the middle skill occupations, it's very hard to make the argument there's a shortage there. And the construction trades, you know, we've lost about a fifth of our construction jobs. I mean, how could you argue there's a shortage here? Right. You know, in manufacturing, you know, the state lost 98,000 jobs over the recovery. We've gotten back 11,000 of them. You know, so it's really tough to – and that's not to say there aren't going to be these little spot shortages in some of the high-end machine trades. But again, the reason why those shortages exist is it takes 4 or 5 years to make a machinist. You know, you were laying off machinists like mad 4 or 5 years ago. So, you know, there's no hiring activity. So how do you make a new machinist? And the only
you make a new machinist?
The way you do it is through apprentice. I mean, it's an apprenticeship, you know, kind of program. You got to pay your dues. And that's not to say that, you know, there isn't a certain amount of things that kids can do in a career tech ed system or a community college to learn those proficiencies. But at the end of the day, that's an on-the-job training kind of job.
And if people – I mean, I'm thinking of those people that have been out of work for 6 months, a year, two, three. I just worry about how they're going to get back into the labor force and how they're going to get back in with a salary they can live on.
Well, it's very unlikely they'll get back. They'll get the salary back that they, especially people that don't have a college degree, it's very unlikely that they'll get the salary back that they had. The issue you raised on, Marty, about people getting stale, you know, sort of like a house gets stale for being in the market. There's actually a growing body of evidence about this, that if we, you know, if people remain unemployed for a very long time to become unemployable, that it's very difficult for them to kind of get back. And then there's part of it is the skills attrification, but the other part is, as employers see somebody out for a year and a half, 2 years, they want no part of that. They see that as a risky buy.
They see the resume.
Exactly. And, you know, you're not going to get through the screen, right? The computer's going to count you out. And so a consequence, it's you know, in an area of great labor supply, why would I take that risk? And the answer is employers tend not to. So long duration's tough.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're talking about the lag in job creation in the state of Pennsylvania. Also, what policies, what strategies would encourage new opportunities for employment? And again, we'd love to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. We have Cheryl from Downingtown joining us. Hi, Cheryl. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I run a group called Joseph's People that has 1,600 middle-class professionals in it who are long-term unemployed. So there are two issues that I would like to see addressed.
Sure.
The first is we have to find a way to force, if necessary, employers to hire people who are 45 to 50 and over. These are people with huge skills who've just been decimated in this economy. So that may take some laws or putting some teeth in existing laws. The second issue, which I really find in the job creation one troubling, is, you know, manufacturers are talking about how wonderful their jobs are, and that's fine, but the largest employer in the state of Pennsylvania is Walmart. So, you know, we're creating jobs, but the vast majority of the jobs that we're creating that I see from the statistics are retail, paying $8 and $9 an hour. my people, who are middle-class people who came from IT or HR or farmer or wherever, have two and three of those jobs. That's a big problem, and it's a big problem for younger people who ought to have those jobs and can't get them. So we have to get away from, and I don't know how we do this.
Right.
Maybe your economist guy has an idea. We have to get away from creating just retail jobs and then patting ourselves on the back as if that's going to cure the economy, because it's not.
Well, Cheryl, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. You raised two very good points. Let's take the last one, Paul, which is that, yes, we are creating jobs, but if you're looking at retail, even I think parts of the hospitality interest, these are, I'm not sure they're low-wage jobs, but they're certainly not much better than that.
Yeah, we're not really creating many retail jobs in the state. You know, the state lost 38,000 jobs over the course of the downturn in the retail trade sector and got back about 13,000. You know, a lot of retail's now moved online, so we're just retail's probably not, you know, going to be a very rapid grower in the state as well. Well, the state actually has added a lot of jobs in some very high-end industries, particularly in the professional and scientific services industry, and that ranges from things like engineering, information technology, consulting activities to business, you know, high-end business finance consulting activities. State's done very well there, and then of course the other area that's been, you know, very strong and very consistently strong has been the health sector. And a lot of that is upend. You know, it's associate, bachelor's, master's jobs as well. So a lot of the growth that we've actually had has been in the college labor market, not in these low-wage jobs. That's, you know, when you look at the color of this recession, it's very blue.
So, I mean, your advice then to someone who's wearing that blue collar, I mean, what do you do?
Well, I think probably, you know, first of all, we're just in this lousy economic environment, and that's sort of beyond the ability of individuals to fix. Having said that, what's the adjustment? How do I get around this? And I think probably two things. One is there are opportunities at the secondary vocational technical education level that well-organized career and tech ed programs do generate positive outcomes. They can't be a massive scale, but they can do really well for kids who go into them. And also technical community colleges, kids that come out of those programs do really well because their education and training is tied specifically to that local labor market. And those and programs that are effective have these relationships with local employers. You know, the guy running the auto mechanics program knows the local garage people, and he can make some placements there. And when you see that kind of relationship develop, you get pretty positive outcomes for youngsters.
Cheryl also talked about, you know, forcing people to hire employees, and I don't know if you can do that in the private business world, but I scribbled down the WPA. I mean, back in the Depression, the government, in a sense, created agencies, organizations in order to hire people.
Well, you know, the paradox is in this economic recession, all the job loss has actually been among people 45 and under. Older workers, people 55 and above, their employment has risen very sharply for two reasons. One, just that big baby boom cohort, you know, stayed in the job market.
A lot of them.
Then the second thing, though, is that their job market participation went up, and they penetrated into teen labor markets. You know, 15 years ago, you didn't see a 60-year-old man or woman working in a retail trade, grocery store, department store. That's very common now. There's very strong evidence that, you know, we've seen this high penetration of these older workers. The other thing is, as manufacturing and construction laid off, who did they lay off? All these young kids. So if you ask yourself who got beat up in this economic downturn, it's people under the age of 30. It is not older workers at all. But and the second issue around, you know, the idea of, you know, is there a way that we could put people to work? I think that if we had done the stimulus a little bit differently, maybe we would have done a little bit better job on that.
I want to pick up on that after this very short break. And if you're just joining us, that's Paul Harrington. He's a labor economist, director of Drexel University Center for Labor Markets and Policy, joining us today in Radio Times as we talk about job growth, skill sets, the state of the economy here in the state of Pennsylvania. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Questions or comments, give us a call, 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Natural Lands Trust supports WHYY. Celebrating its 60th year, Natural Lands Trust has preserved more than 100,000 acres of the region's landscapes. Information about how your support can keep communities green for future generations and details about outings, volunteer opportunities, and nature preserves are available at natlands.org. Natural Lands Trust. Land for life.
What do you do when you're little and you know you can't be like your mother? I adore and am proud of my mother, but what she wants from me is blind adherence to the mystifying virtue of seemly behavior.
On the next Fresh Air, Patricia Volk talks about her new memoir, Shocked, about her relationship with her mother. And we'll hear an excerpt of a recent lecture by Martin Scorsese about film history. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. As the Boston bombing investigation continues, we'll speak with Muslims who want to tell us what they think their role is in monitoring members of their mosque. Also, niceness. Why do we applaud? Romans used to shake their togas. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Today on the show, what we can do to encourage employment here in the state of Pennsylvania. And again, Paul Harrington, our guest, labor economist, director of Drexel University Center for Labor Markets and Policy. Well, the phone's just exploded at 1-888-477-9499. But, Paul, right before the break, you mentioned the stimulus and raised some questions. Maybe it wasn't strong enough, it wasn't big enough, it didn't do enough.
I think the composition of the stimulus probably could have been a little bit better. I think some of the infrastructure investments probably would be a better place to put that money rather than some of the places we did do it. You know, we were making bets on individual companies and the like, and I don't think that's very wise. I think engaging in highway building, airport building, ports, pipelines, would have been a really important thing. And then the second thing, though, that you raised, Marty, around this idea of sort of a WPA.
Yeah.
You know, there are just cities that where work has disappeared. And, you know, and going into those neighborhoods where work has disappeared and trying to rebuild a culture of work, I think has some real value. And that's something we ought to, and it's a cheap way to actually create jobs to get people back engaged in a job market who have been out for a long time. I think there's some value to that.
And how would that work? How would something like that work?
Well, I think what you'd try and do is figure out, could I use a system of wage subsidies with private sector employers? Could I engage in certain kinds of public works projects under city and state management? And basically target these are people that have been out of the job market for a long time, particularly young men. A lot of the young guys' labor force attachment, particularly in Philadelphia, is not high. And trying to get these guys back engaged in the world, you know, they're not in school, not in, you know, when you take a look at the data about kids 20 to 24, not in school, not in work, not in the military, it's not a pretty picture in the city.
There was a piece yesterday in the New York Times, how social networks drive black unemployment. And the author of the article talked about the fact that the unemployment rate for black workers is something like 13%. It's probably more than that in Philadelphia. But she talks about favoritism. Getting an inside edge by using help from family or friends is a powerful hidden force driving inequality in the United States. The idea that, I guess, if you know someone who knows someone who has a job, that's a very good entree into the work world.
Yeah, it is. But if you looked at this economic recession and say, why did black men get killed? You know, because they did. And the answer is because they're disproportionately employed in construction and manufacturing. And we had this massive job loss there. And, you know, black guys with high school diplomas, some college, got absolutely wiped out as a consequence of this. The blue-collar black guys bore the brunt of this downturn by far, particularly younger ones.
And we're talking about the construction...
Construction and manufacturing.
And manufacturing.
Yep, so as blue-collar black men really got roughed up, the worst of any demographic group in the economy.
So how do we help them?
Well, again, you know, it's you know, the prospects for manufacturing coming back aren't great. You know, construction will probably rebound, but it's going to be a while before it gets back even to where we were in 2007. So the question is do these kind of, you know, local jobs program and infrastructure kind of programs help these guys down the road? And I think they're probably the best bet.
Well, you mentioned infrastructure, which, you know, 10 years ago was just no one even knew what you were talking about. Right. And it's probably the nerdiest word in the English language at this point. But, you know, I've said this, I've lost count of how many times on this show about the crying need in the state of Pennsylvania, bridges and roads all in need of repair. And it seems so. Here's the need. Here's a potential workforce. How do we bring them together?
Well, I think you know, part of the problem is the state finances have been so shifted into entitlement kinds of activities that, you know, the sorts of decisions you need to make around infrastructure investments gets pushed to the side. So there's got to be a real rethink about how we allocate resources and what the priorities are in the state. because I don't mean to single out Pennsylvania. I mean all states.
Right.
We need to get more job oriented, and we need to make our social policy a policy that says the way we're going to alleviate problems of poverty and income inadequacy is through work. And that's across all age groups, including older workers.
Older workers as well. Let me get some callers in. Looks like we have Dan from Walnutport, Pennsylvania. Dan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Professor Harrington, you mentioned earlier about the baby boomer age workers being more highly employed, higher employment rate. But isn't their earning potential dramatically diminished because some of those workers were perhaps, you know, people like me who had many years of employment experience, higher wages, and lost their position and now have taken lower-paying jobs?
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, particularly if you see, you know, men and women that worked in the manufacturing sector get dislocated in their mid-50s, wanted to stay in the job market, mm-hmm. and then get laid off. Their chances of being reemployed are diminished, and their earnings losses are very large.
And Dan, what are you doing these days?
Well, thankfully, I'm employed pretty much at the same level as I was before, but I know that many colleagues, actually had that happen to them. They had to take a position in a much lower-paying area.
Right.
Thanks for the call to Radio Times. But also, St. Paul, taking the jobs that a younger worker might be using as an entree?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of substitution of older workers of teens by older workers.
Let me get, looks like Ivana from Williamstown, New Jersey. Ivana, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I know that your discussion primarily has been about manufacturing work, but I know that in the IT field, which is the field that I'm in, a lot of the jobs that would go to natural citizens are going to people that are being insourced from other countries.
Yeah, there is.
Thanks, Ivana.
Yeah, there is a great dispute about the role of H-1B visa programs in particular. And, what basically I see is that at the master's and doctor's degree level in the U.S., very, very high fractions of our students, and when I mean high, I mean 60 to 70% of our students who receive degrees come in on an F-1B visa. We just have very few native-born kids that go in engineering, IT, and actually many of the hard sciences. We just don't get many kids into those fields. So as a result, you've seen firms really shift over to the H-1B program. Problem with the H-1B program is that it's very poorly administered. There's some shucksters out there that are using that as a way to illegally bring
I've
in.
I've heard some stories about that.
So it's a very badly administered program. It's a very bad way to run your immigration program. And to be blunt with you, the way we do immigration in the United States is pretty nuts.
Well, that's a topic for another day, an important topic for another day. But we hear about these STEM programs, mm-hmm. or STEM, science, technology, engineering, mm-hmm. I guess, and math.
Yep.
Sounds like we need to build up that part of our population.
It's hard to say. You know, when you look at the SAT scores of kids coming out of high school, there's lots of kids with strong math proficiencies. You know, the top quarter of our high school graduating class are, you know, they're competitive with everybody in the world. Part of the problem is getting kids interested in those fields. And when you look at the engineering field and the IT field, they tend to be more seasonal or cyclically sensitive fields. So you think about the back in the 80s and 90s, the IT field was the hot field. Then we had the dot-com bust and job market collapsed there for a while, and that pushed away a lot of kids from that major. And then as that IT field kind of healed itself and recovered, now we're starting to get kids back. But economists call it a cobweb model of labor supply, where there's sort of a big lag between when demand emerges and when we actually create the supply because of the training time.
But it sounds like we need more people in those fields.
I think that we in the engineering and information technology side, absolutely. In the hard science side, there's less evidence that there's a problem there.
Let me see what Ryan from Robesonia, Pennsylvania has to say. Ryan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Hi. I'm 44, and I'm employed. I'm a delivery driver, and I'm going to an online school, Phoenix Online, for business management. I know these are for-profit institutions, and they're really producing a lot of people and sending them into the market, and I'm wondering, is this a positive, career track, or is this just adding to the labor force?
Yeah, no, this is the question of the day.
Yeah, and Ryan, let me just ask you, what are you studying?
I'm sorry?
What are you studying, Ryan?
Business management.
Business management, okay. So what do you think?
Yeah, Marty, I went back the other day and I asked myself, what did we think in the early 2000s? How many college degrees did we think we'd grant by 2010? And then how many did we grant? So I went and looked at the projections. We thought we were going to increase college degrees by about 288,000. We increased it by almost a million. At the same period of time, how many jobs did we add in the American economy? The answer was minus 1 million. So, you know, this is, again, this big oversupply issue. What you really find is, and you asked exactly the right question, what are you studying?
Yes.
And the economic returns to a college degree are very closely dependent on how you answer that question.
And what would be the correct
answer? Well, kind of getting back to the STEM thing. You know, it's math is hard. And so it winnows people out, you know, in engineering and IT fields. Those are very difficult programs to get through. It's hard to get a kid through that. And so as a result, the math-dominant fields tend to have the highest wages and best employment prospects of all the undergraduate major fields of study, followed, you know, by the only social science that makes the top 10 is economics, and that's because it's a little bit mathy.
Ryan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. But are you saying that we have that too many people are going to college?
Well,
or that we have this disconnect?
I think we are. I think, you know, back in 2009, we sent 70% of our high school seniors into college in the fall following their graduation from high school. It's a stunningly large number. And where almost all these youngsters end up is parts of the higher ed system where the likelihood you'll actually graduate isn't very high, you know, community college system. So, you know, in Pennsylvania, you bring in 100 kids in a full-time cohort. 3 years later, you know, 150% of the time a degree, what you'll find is, and this is full-time students, what you'll find is that about 14 out of 100 will actually earn a degree.
14 out of 100.
Yeah. And you know, the idea is, well, they're going to transfer to other institutions, but the evidence about the transfer is not good. Maybe another 20% will transfer, but of those who do transfer, the fraction they end up getting a degree is not high. So there's a lot of churning in the higher education system, particularly at, you know, lesser selective kind of institutions, where a lot of resources get chewed up. We just don't necessarily create a lot of output. You know, the exception to that is there's a little public technical college down in Lancaster, which I got to get to, called Thaddeus Stevens College. And they graduate kids at very high rates. Why? I think because when I look at their program mix, they're very closely tied to the job market.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you need to graduate from high school. It seems to me that if you don't, you have enormous hurdles and barriers to employment. But it sounds like also we need to figure out something then after high school.
Because, you know, if you look and ask yourself, what kid is successful? It's a kid that is focused and directed. So, you know, the kid who goes to that Thaddeus Stevens College down there, that's a kid. I want to be an automotive repair. I know I have the means to do this and I can see the outcome. And what you find is a lot of times is that, you know, college is plan B. I can't get a job. It's August. What do I do? Well, I guess, you know, mom says you're not going to sit in the couch all fall. So get out there and, you know, go sign up for some classes. So there's really not a focus and direction for that youngster. And that's, I think, an important thing we need to think through.
Let me get Michael from Swarthmore to join us. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
In terms of direction, I find this really interesting. Me and my father owns a sizable, still small business that's machine shop based.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, it's always been, he complains about how hard it is to find a good machinist.
Mm-hmm.
And at least personally for me, I'm 22, and the educational environment I've been around, you hear the word vocational school brought up, kind of as like a cool, like, yeah, that's a good idea thing. But I never really noticed much push for it around me by, you know, educators or whatnot.
Right.
And I think about, you know, someone coming out of high school, yes, it's a blue-collar job, but it's one that can be very rewarding, enjoyable, and certainly a path. I believe within like 2 years, my dad pays out about like $42,000, almost base pay plus benefits, for like a good machinist. So, I mean, and again, in today's economy, it's kind of borderline silly that you can't find a good machinist.
Well, Mike, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Does that seem like borderline silly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, part of the problem is you know, again, the kind of the short-term business cycle condition creates a lot of demand for, you know, machinists, but in the long term, will that stay? That's a separate issue. But, you know, part of what I see in Pennsylvania is, and I think what Michael said about the vocational technical system in the state is right, that there's really not much interest in it. And, you know, when you look at my old state of Massachusetts, the vocational technical system up there is very oversubscribed, very high demand. They're among the best high schools in the state, among the highest performing with respect to academic proficiency. Very high attendance. Outcomes for the students in terms of job market outcomes are very good. Post-secondary enrollment, very high. But part of the reason why that's the case is that, unlike Pennsylvania, the academic and occupational program instruction is integrated. They are their own separate high schools. They are, in fact, their own separate school districts. So, you know, when every parent out there has heard the kid say, why do I have to know algebra? Well, when you go to that vocational class and you know, you're calculating the area of a cylinder and you put a piston in that engine and it doesn't fit, you got your answer.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller in. This is Tom from Phoenixville. Tom, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. The word I don't hear in any of this, and that's the only thing that creates jobs, is innovation. You can either cost control, you can innovate, you can't do both. And what I've seen as an engineer in PA, everybody wants to cost control, and therefore we don't innovate. Electrical engineers are treated as TV repairmen.
Well, that's interesting, Tom. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Paul,
yeah,
he didn't say the word innovation.
Because I love engineers and I hire engineers as research assistants. And because they are innovative, they do have that entrepreneurial spirit. They're a little bit of a different breed, to be honest with you. But they are the creators. They are the innovators and engaging in things that, supporting research and development in the private sector, I think, is a fundamental role for the state. Right. And federal government and encouraging that kind of investment in kind of an infrastructure set where we're not betting on specific technologies, but betting on kind of broader underlying research activities that can capitalize on the skills and abilities of the scientific proficiencies we have in the state.
With the kind of brain and thinking that goes along with
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
Tom, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And Paul Harrington, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. No problem. And he's a labor economist and, again, director of Drexel University's Center for Labor Markets and Policy. We began our conversation with David N. Taylor, executive director, first vice president of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can learn a lot about this program. In fact, carry on conversations that we do start here on the air. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter, and you can certainly send us an email as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, assistance from Emily Bryant today. The program is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.